Highway, which is in Philadelphia, which is the sixth of podcast.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Sixth Sense Podcast. Joining me is in studios, once again, the infamous Graham Creech. Creech, what's up, man? How are you?
Good, man. Beautiful day today. How are you doing?
A little warm. Not going to lie. It was a little warm coming into the studios.
On the walkover, yeah.
But making the trek, yeah.
Nice little breeze and nice day for a patio and a beer. Or a couple.
Can't argue with that. First things first, the Ottawa Senators have made a couple moves since we've been in here last time. Obviously, they've gone out and signed the Joe Corvo. Welcome back, Joe.
Uh-oh.
Between the Bruce Garriott -1 and Joe Corvo's return, it's been kind of a wet dream for the Ottawa Sun sports section. So, what are your thoughts on Corvo coming back?
I guess he's a depth defenseman that's going to help out on the power play.
900K. He's taking a hit in the wallet. Still an offensive defenseman who can score some goals.
He's still got a bomb. Like, for sure, if he's getting fed passes from Erik Karlsson or Patrick Wierkosz on that first or second unit, he's going to be able to let some blasts go.
Hold up just a second. On the first unit with Patrick Wierkosz.
I said first or second unit. I said, go back and listen after. I said on the first or second unit.
Erik Karlsson would come in here and slap you around if you heard that.
I said with Erik Karlsson or Patrick Wierkosz, either on the first or second
unit. Selective hearing on my part then. Yeah. I only heard Patrick Wierkosz. My apologies.
Maybe I didn't enunciate and make it clear, but that's what I meant anyways.
But they need someone for that second power play unit. Now that Sergei Gonchar is gone. Jared Cowan is a guy that could possibly slide into that role a little bit more than he has in the past. Chris Phillips has kind of been in and out of that situation before. Scored a couple goals.
Never liked
at various points,
him
but
as
he's,
an option
yeah,
on power play.
He's nothing that you really... He puts the puck on net.
Yeah.
That's one thing you can give Phillips credit for. But having kind of a veteran guy who's done it before and done it with some varying levels of success, I suppose it's great to have Joe Corvo back as a sixth or seventh defenseman on the cheap.
Yeah, for sure, I guess. We'll see how he handles playing in Ottawa again. I know he didn't have kind things to say last time he left.
Do you think that is spin, though? Because he was kind of... miffed, I guess, the last time he came through town. Obviously, Don Brennan was pretty vocal about Corvo's gaffes with the puck. Do you believe that there was a lot of buildup for him wanting to leave because he thought it was a tough town to play in?
I think so, a little bit, but also I think there was a confidence issue. Like you heard in post-game comments, he'd always be down on himself saying how he screwed up and... You didn't know if he could
get over
certain plays.
That whole self-deprecating, yeah.
So,
for whatever reason, though, I remember him leaving when he was traded with Patrick Eves at the time for Mike Commodore and Corey Stillman. I remember at the time that he spun it. I guess Murray said he came to him and asked for a trade. And I remember him coming back. I remember there being a quote in the media saying, no, I didn't come out and ask for a trade. So there was a little bit of that controversy. I've tried to look for that quote, and I can't find it. So maybe it's one of those other things where it was selective hearing and
yeah.
I'm misremembering, as Roger Clemens would say. But, Joe Corvo's back with his many tattoos. I'm excited.
Don't you love those star tattoos on his...
Yes, very nice.
Right in your shoulders?
Very nice. Yeah. You have the same pair, don't you?
Yeah, that's me. Not quite. He does have a bomb, though. We'll give him that, and it's cheap. We'll see how he does in his own zone. I guess, who is he going to be paired with? Philly?
Yeah. Well, the way that the defensive pairings are going to shake out, it's going to be interesting to watch. You'll have Mathot with Karlsson, and that was an exceptional pair before Karlsson got hurt, obviously. Second pair, you're probably going to have Wierkosz and Cowan, I'd imagine.
That's probably where I'd slot them.
Especially based off pay. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
Chris Phillips on the third pairing with Corvo and possibly, Mark Borowiecki and Eric Greiba.
Yeah.
Doesn't really instill that much confidence.
I'd say there's probably going to be quite a bit of movement between on that bottom pairing, guys coming in out of the lineup. They'll probably have about eight guys.
And even still, there isn't much. Even though Corvo did play for Ottawa back years ago towards the 2007 Cup run, it's not like he played a lot with Phillips. Phillips was anchored with Volchenko for the bulk of that time. So there isn't that much chemistry, even though they were teammates at that time.
Yeah. I'm just thinking slot wise. Like, I wouldn't want him on my in my top four, seeing that kind of minutes.
And I wouldn't want to be standing in front of the net on the power play either. You have no idea where it's going.
He torched the Senators, though. I should have his numbers.
Oh, God. There's the one hat trick game. I was watching the highlights of that after the news broke, and I was just looking at it. And yeah, he's come back to haunt Ottawa in a few games.
Clark MacArthur, too. They got
another guy who's historically played quite well for Toronto against Ottawa.
Didn't he bust out of that 21 or 22 game goal scoring or goalless streak against Ottawa? And he's always put up numbers against Ottawa.
Just one of those things.
Moving on.
Remember when Murray said that Kovalev used to torch Ottawa too?
Yeah, that
sometimes you
game.
Just can't hang your hat on that stuff, though.
No, looking for positives.
You're such an optimist. Okay. So let's get into the other signings. Patrick Wierkosz, 3-year extension, $2 million per. Too much, too little, just about right. What are your thoughts on the Wierkosz signing?
Hard to complain about $2 million. At the same time,
especially when Mark Frazier was going into arbitration asking for $2 million. Eventually he did settle, but yeah, relative to what's being signed elsewhere, Patrick Wierkosz, point production wise for that position,
it'll give him 3 years, and maybe this will be a huge bargain on the third year of the deal when he's putting up 15 goals a season.
And that's what you're looking for from Ottawa's perspective. You're looking for to get that investment back. Maybe you don't make your money back this season, but over the final year or last year, final 2 years of the deal, they're looking to get a little bang for the buck. And hard to complain with $2 million.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
It'll be interesting to see how he does without Gonchar, though.
Yeah, for sure. Even I think he had some comments with the Ottawa Sun, I think, after his contract or his re-signing, and he said that he learned a lot from him, and there was never, like, he still feels like there was tons he could learn from him. So I think he will miss that.
What do you think about this, though? He's playing with Gonchar, another excellent puck-moving defenseman, quick on the breakout, good transition skills. Now Wierkosz is essentially going to be the go-to guy to move the puck on the second pairing. Probably could help his point numbers as well. Conversely,
probably will.
What do you think about that?
The other thing too is that if he's slotted with, well, basically whoever other than a Joe Corvo, he'll probably be with a Griba or Cowan or someone like that. So he'll have someone that's going to be backing him up majority of the time instead of looking for offensive chances. So he'll have support there,
As well as the opportunity to carry the puck himself.
Yeah, exactly. Join the rush because there'll be that stay home guy. So I'd expect his numbers to increase.
You'd hope so.
Especially probably for sure seeing first unit power play, if not East Q being the second unit.
Mm-hmm. Can't complain about that. How many points did he have last year? Offhand?
19 points, 5 goals.
In 42 games. But he didn't play a lot down the stretch because he was hurt.
Yeah.
I don't think it was necessarily a coaching decision.
No, he hurt his, was his ankle?
Sure. I thought it was lower body.
Lower body, yeah.
I wasn't sure if it was like groin, hammy, hip.
It was he was in the corner, eh? He fell kind of weird and, yeah, lower.
Played
body.
A playoff game and then was out of the lineup shortly thereafter and never played again after that. That was in the Montreal series,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, that was Montreal series.
I don't think that's a reflection of him as a rookie, though. I think it was actually the injury that limited his ice time down the stretch.
Yeah, in that series, I believe so, too. But I believe he was healthy to come back at one point and we just kind of.
And then just tweaked it.
Because he had the one playoff game.
Ludvig Carlson, added to the prospect coffer. A Swedish forward who took an unconventional route to get to the NHL. Well, he's not there yet. He could play in the AHL. But he signed with the Senators, 2-year ELC. Not bad. Can't really complain. You haven't seen the kid play, obviously, first things first.
Nothing I can comment based on what I've seen. 15 goals in 2 years.
Big body, 6'2", 6'3", 200 pounds, I believe.
Yeah, listed on the HockeyDB as 6'3", 200. Left shot.
Had some offensive skills playing for Northeastern.
Or left shot D.
Left shot
D. I'm thinking of a Canadian Olympic. shoots left. He's a winger. Projects as what? Everywhere I've read, I think projects as at best a third line winger.
Yeah.
North-South player.
I asked Steph G about him. Hasn't seen him in years because he has been playing overseas. He played in the USHL. And then he made the adjustment and went up to the Northeastern University out on the East Coast, close to Boston. Actually, I think it's within Boston, to be honest. I had a buddy who actually played baseball there. So I should know that. But yeah, good depth signing for the organization. Obviously, they traded away a number of prospects to Anaheim to bring in Bobby Ryan. So bringing another potential depth player into the organization who can hopefully fulfill, you know, a top 9 role at some point down the road. not a bad move. Tough to argue with it right now.
Hope so, bingo, if that's where he's starting next year. Probably, where I'd assume.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Europeans choosing a North American route to work their way to the NHL.
Yep.
Want to talk about, about the other unsigned player?
The other unsigned player. Yeah, you wouldn't know it based off the... Yeah, you wouldn't know it based off... All right, you're actually breaking out sad French music. You're actually doing this. We were joking about this off air, but you're doing it.
It's for you.
Okay. Stéphane DaCosta. Creeched, for those of you who are listening. YouTubed sad French songs, and this is what came up.
The Last Farewell.
The Last Farewell.
I didn't, honestly didn't even do that on purpose.
But yes, in the Ottawa Sun the other day, they had an article talking about Jared Cowan being the last man standing amongst the RFAs who are still awaiting new contracts. And...
You want to keep that going?
You can keep going. It doesn't affect me at all.
I'm not going to tear up?
No. Well, maybe. Not yet.
All right.
Let
me know if it's too much.
Stéphane DaCosta, also an RFA who hasn't been signed to a contract yet. What do you think is happening with Stéphane DaCosta?
Well, they qualified him, right?
Yes.
And he hasn't signed.
Right.
So...
He's still going to be organizational property.
Maybe he's trying to get moved, or maybe he's thinking about heading back across the pond. Not sure. There's not too much out there.
It's interesting, though, because essentially he has been passed on the depth chart, conceivably by every center within Ottawa's system. What are you doing? Keep it going.
You want to keep
going?
We're
still talking about him.
All right.
We're still talking about him. Derek Grant was called up last year. Jean-Gabriel Pageau.
He's
called up last year.
There's nowhere to slot him.
So if you're DaCosta, you can't. If you're representing DaCosta, you can't expect a one-way contract. Sorry. So are you hoping for big AHL money, or is overseas the route that you're thinking? Is he going to fill it, Tavi?
Depends what he wants to do.
DaCosta don't do rebounds.
DaCosta don't do bottom 6 minutes.
This is beautiful.
I can't believe you're still loving this.
Oh, it's great.
Compelling
podcast.
I can't even concentrate. Seriously, though, there's, in my opinion, I've always thought that he's going to succeed in the NHL. Well, if he does succeed, it would for sure be in top six. He's a playmaker. He passes the puck. He's small.
He's Adam Oates part two.
Doesn't give you anything else.
No.
So.
Not Adam Oates part two.
Well, he hasn't shown that yet.
No.
Not that he's being given a
size and strength. Size and strength has always been the issue with him, right? Since he entered the league. And going back to conversations that we've had with other people, him going back to Merrimack College last year to train, I don't know if he went back to school to finish a degree. So I don't know why he opted to go that route as opposed to other prospects
camp.
Who went through Chris Schwartz and other Randy Lee and other developmental guys within the organization. Just spend that time in Ottawa, show them that you're keen. Show them that you're a team player. Mind you, you know what? It's almost unfair to say that without knowing the situation. But you wonder how long he is for the organization at this point.
Might be the last farewell.
Well played. Well played.
If he hasn't signed his qualifying offer, he's clearly debating on what he's going to do.
Right.
At this point, I don't think there's no fit.
Well, there's no opportunity right here. If you're an offensive forward who can't crack a pro team's top two lines, you're going to have a hard time getting to the show, especially as an undersized forward.
He's not the first guy to have that happen to him.
So. No. Corey Locke. People still complain about Corey Locke and not getting a fair shake in Ottawa.
What did he get? 5 games, I think? I think he got 5 games, 1 assist.
Yeah.
I think so. Now, I don't know how many he's played with Montreal and New York or Minnesota, whoever.
Right.
But I think he got 5 games in Ottawa. He had, 80-something points in 60, 70 games in their Calder Cup winning year. He was injured in the playoffs, but still put up almost point-of-game numbers in the playoffs.
Yep.
But, yeah, it's either you make it as an elite scoring forward in the NHL or you kind of don't if you're that kind of player.
Yeah, you fall by the wayside. You fall by the wayside.
Nothing wrong with being a elite AHL player.
And this song actually goes on for 6 minutes and 15 seconds. That's hard to believe. But we're still talking DaCosta. But we can switch it up, so you can end then.
All right.
Elliot Friedman switching things up, Ellie Freeman was on Team 1200. He was commenting on the whole Alfie speculation, what went wrong, and how we wound up at a certain point. I was looking at some tweets in retrospect, and Steph G had one where he was watching Swedish TV, and Alfredson was essentially answering a question, when do you expect to sign a contract with Ottawa? And he essentially said, today or hopefully tomorrow at the earliest. Here we are. Alfredson's in Detroit. I don't want to, you know, go back to the whole what the hell happened. But Elliot Friedman hit on a point that I thought was interesting, in which he said someone had told him that perhaps there is more to the whole bad blood between J.P. Barrie, Daniel Alfredson's representation, and the owner, Eugene Melnyk. And for me, I have a hard time stomaching the fact that a player who spent 17 seasons within this organization, who took numerous pay cuts, deferred salary to help this team through the Bryden years and to make the payroll work and help bring in guys at the deadline so that they could possibly make a run at it. I have a hard time thinking that guy is all of a sudden going to let representation who possibly has bad blood with the team's owner dictate the way that negotiations actually turn out.
Yeah, me too. I don't have much to add to it because it's all
he said, she said.
Exactly.
Right?
The whole thing has been. I think that there's probably, we discussed this on the podcast after free agency and after everything that happened, and there's probably a bit more that not everyone knows, but and some kind of issue or someone feeling disrespected, but...
And the Healy thing was 4 years ago. 4 years. And you're still harboring that resentment? If true, I have a hard time believing that. Unless you really want to hold that grudge. I don't... To me, it seems a bit silly. You have the face of the franchise, part and parcel, everything that has been iconic of the Senators over the past 20 seasons. You're not going to let him go because of some bad blood from negotations that happened 4 years ago.
Doesn't make
assuming
sense.
That's even true. So we've been talking for, you know, 50 minutes or more. One thing that we haven't talked about is our podcast guests coming up. Joining us later on will be Harrison Mooney from Puck Daddy. He's going to talk to us about the Heritage Classic that's being revived for the first time in a couple of years. Ottawa is playing the Vancouver Canucks. So we'll get a little bit of that Van City perspective on what's going on and whether there's any buzz pertaining to it. I know it's a ways off. It's in March next year. But we can get some vibe on what's going on in Vancouver. And joining us is Rob Volman, who recently wrote the Hockey Abstract book, which is on Amazon.com. And I highly encourage everyone to go ahead and buy it. I believe the PDF is like $14 or something, and then the actual book version is close to $20. So he'll be on to talk a little Senators hockey sabermetrics.
Fancy stats.
Yeah, he actually predicted that Ottawa had the best odds of winning the President's Trophy. Before he comes on, did you want to hit on that?
Well, I'd just like to ask him questions about how they calculated those numbers in terms of 38%. Of the 30, standings.
32.2, I think, was the final number.
Well, I think 38% of the standings come from luck.
Yeah.
So I just kind of want to figure out how he got that number. And just, I guess there's probably, I'm not the only one trying to figure that out. So we'll just get him to explain that.
But as someone who has admitted in the past that you're not the most, you don't go by numbers as being like the be-all, end-all, right?
Oh no, for sure, and
like which is the smart thing to do. But at the same time,
it's piece
you
of the
hear
puzzle.
When you hear Ottawa Senators President's Trophy candidates 2013-14, your first emotion was
no,
no,
no. I don't see that happening.
I think there's a lot to like, though.
It's
in terms of depth interspersed with some young talent. I think there's a lot to like. Are they at that level yet?
That's right. I don't think. When you're thinking, okay, who's going to finish the top three couple teams this year in this coming season? You always think about the powerhouse teams, and
yeah, Boston, Chicago.
The way that the Senators were manhandled by Pittsburgh in the playoffs, like I don't see them being the best team in the league.
No, but in fairness, Ottawa, they were banged up.
Oh, yeah, and they were for sure. And I think
and I mean,
they're
you know what, though, Pittsburgh was too.
I think they'll be improved, especially I don't know if all these Sens fans, six Sens fans realize, but you are the one that jinxed this team this year.
Why? What'd I do?
You said there is no way this team can be as healthy as they were the year before.
Yeah, but you're giving me way too much credit. That's just me looking at a number from the previous season saying, oh, shit, we got lucky, guys. And this year, you know, you look back at the season that Ottawa had in 2013, you're like, man, that's a lot of bad luck. There's no freaking way that'll happen again.
Yeah, I think
and
they'll
it
be
could,
improved.
But the odds of that happening are small. So, I mean,
put it this way. I have no numbers to argue that they're not going to be the President's Trophy winning team. So Rob Volman calculated that they will be.
And if they do, dude looks like a genius. Before we get talking to Rob, how about we call Harrison?
Talk some winter.
Winter Classics. Find out what's going on in
Some New Jerseys. Classic.
Sure. Whatever. So when we get back, we'll talk to Harrison Mooney from Puck Daddy. Stay tuned. All right, listeners, joining us on the line from Vancouver is Puck Daddy's Harrison Mooney. Harrison, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
No, thanks for coming on. So what's the vibe out in Vancouver now that Ottawa is playing the Vancouver Canucks in this March 3rd Heritage Classic?
Well, I think there are some fans who are really excited about it. You know, BC Place is a cool venue, and for the last couple of years, you know, people have been grumbling that all of these outdoor games are going to be out east. And so, you know, to get one out west here, it's nice. Feels like the NHL kind of threw us a bone. But at the same time, there are those of us, and I would be in the second camp here, who kind of feel like maybe the NHL should have thrown us a better bone. You know, this game is in March, when it's historically kind of warm and also really rainy out. I think 9 out of the last 10 March 2nd, it's rained here in Vancouver, so there's a pretty good chance it'll rain again. And if you're playing an outdoor game, well, you know, how are you going to do that? It doesn't make any sense. So, I don't know.
So what kind of contingency plans do they have in the event that it does rain? Are they going to close the roof? What's going to happen?
Well, I don't know. You know, they're not really talking about that right now, but, I mean, it seems to me like if it's raining, you know, you close the roof. That's why you have a roof that opens and closes. But, you know, this causes a bit of a problem because the moment you close the roof, you are, I believe, technically, this is what we refer to as indoors. So I don't know how you can call it an outdoor game if you're going to shut the rain out.
What kind of, we're looking at this Ottawa-Vancouver matchup, not a lot of history between the two clubs. I suppose you could look at them arguably as two of the best Canadian teams for their respective conferences. Are people in Vancouver excited about this bill at all?
Not really. I mean, if you want to talk about history, like there is some here, right? Because 100 years ago, Vancouver won its only Stanley Cup, and we did it by taking it away from the Ottawa Senators. So there's that. This is really a century-old grudge match. Want to put a little bit of historical context? I should point out that was a sweet series because you know, they were called the Vancouver Millionaires then, and basically they won the Stanley Cup by just spending a bunch of money. They bought Cyclone Taylor away from Ottawa and then immediately challenged the Senators to the Stanley Cup with their own star player. So, you know, maybe Ottawa's still upset about that. Maybe there's somebody in the organization, a history buff, who says, you know what, we got to get Vancouver for the way they stole Cyclone Taylor from us and promised him a lot of money and a job in the federal government in order to do it. So, you know, we're going to come to Vancouver and we're going to win the Heritage Classic.
See, that's
that
a bit,
could be the case.
See, that's a bit of a sore spot for us right now because we're hearing you say an owner who spends money. We're looking at Ottawa's payroll right now. And we're like, oh, that'd be so nice.
Yes, yeah, some owners spend money. Some do.
So speaking of the Millionaires, has there been any announcement? Are they making new jerseys or are they going to be wearing the Millionaires uniforms that they've worn in previous years?
They haven't said that, but it does sound like what they're going to be doing is bringing back the Millionaires jersey that they used against the Detroit Red Wings last year. You know, the rumor that we had heard was that they originally wanted to actually debut that Millionaires jersey against the Senators, and then the lockout happened, and it turned out that, you know, they weren't able to play a game against the Senators. So this is kind of a second chance at that. Plus, the game where they did use those Millionaires jerseys against the Red Wings was pretty much the worst game they played all year. Like, they looked like a team from 1912 playing the 2013 Detroit Red Wings. You know, they didn't really know what a forward pass was. They weren't sure that, you know, defenders can step up beyond the blue line. Like, it was just dumb. So I think if they want to get the stink of that jersey off of them, they'll use it again and win that game.
So we have to ask you. Obviously, Vancouver has been kind of a hot spot for, not controversy, but just there's a lot of hot-button issues going on. You have the whole Luongo situation with Corey Schneider being moved this offseason. You have John Tortorella coming in for Alain Vigneault. Why don't you just take us through each of those respective hires and what the city's feeling at this point?
Well, which one do we want to start with here? Because I've got strong opinions on all of them.
Let's go with the goaltending first.
Well, I mean, the goaltending situation it got completely out of control. You know, Mike Gillis, when he made that trade, sending Corey Schneider to New Jersey, you know, he went up and he says in front of the media, you know, we had a plan 3 years ago and we were going to move Corey Schneider for a high draft pick. And then he said other things and we kind of ignored everything else. But what he actually said after that was, you know, the plan changed. And we decided that Corey Schneider was, you know, a goalie of the future and blah, 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 blah. But now we're back to the original plan. And the issue here is the Canucks completely got in over their heads with the goalie situation. As good as Corey Schneider was, they had Roberto Luongo locked up. There's no question that he can take them through the Stanley Cup final. He already showed he can do that. I think if that team hadn't imploded defensively, they win the Stanley Cup final. So I don't think it's an issue of, you know, whether or not they think Corey Schneider's a smidgen better. They had Luongo locked up. They should have stuck to that plan. And they didn't stick to that plan. Instead, everything got silly. They tried to move this lifetime contract. And, you know, those contracts are not worked in a way for you to move them. The fact is, when you sign a guy to that deal, you're assuming he's going to stay. And instead, they tried to move it. The lockout happens. Come out of the lockout. Suddenly the rule has changed, and now these contracts are basically poisonous. And then the Canucks try to back out of it instead and trade Schneider and, you know, make everything better with Luongo, and they blew it, you know? I think it's great that Luongo's not saying anything right now because it's just making them sweat. You know he's going to come back. You know he has absolutely no other option. But at the same time, if he has no other option and they screwed him over, it is, as far as I'm concerned, well within his rights to say nothing all summer and let the team stew awkwardly and just fidget and have everybody blame that and point fingers at them for the way they handled the situation.
What do you make of him firing his longtime agent? Do you think he's trying to get moved still or to not report?
I don't think so. Gilles Lupien, his agent, he doesn't have a whole lot of hockey clients. I mean, he already got Luongo the lifetime deal. I don't think that there's much more that he could do for Luongo. I think now Luongo is looking at things like, you know, more poker appearances. This is something he wants to do, something he really likes to do. And he wants a guy who's going to be able to set him up with that, get him some different interviews, maybe do a little bit better job of shielding him from some of the media scrutiny. Just a bunch of things that agents do beyond just negotiating contracts that Lupien hasn't really done for Luongo all that well, I think. So I don't think it's, you know, he's hired another agent and he's hoping that agent is going to somehow get in here, look at this contract and be like, oh, well, here's something the last guy missed. It turns out that you actually can rip the whole thing up. Like, that's not going to happen. You know, he's not going to help Luongo fake his death and, you know, reappear as a grizzled longshore worker. Like, none of that's happening. I think it really is just about some of the non-contractual stuff that agents do.
We're hearing sirens on your end. Everything good?
Yeah, I was halfway through a run when you called, so I'm just kind of out here in beautiful Vancouver. We haven't had a rainy day in 30 days. It's gorgeous right now. So.
Well, hopefully that holds out till March for you then. Question for you. Obviously, Vancouver's been a bit renowned. We're having Rob Volman on later from HockeyAbstract.com. He's going to be talking some sabermetrics with us. Alain Vigneault and the Vancouver Canucks have kind of been renowned for being at the forefront of their progressive ways of doing things. We're talking like zone starts and everything else. Obviously, John Tortorella is coming in with a bit of a different back history and in regards to the way that he operates a team. How has the community responded to Tortorella's hire?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about the advanced stats community, you know, the Alain Vigneault firing was it was a contentious thing because I think there were a lot of things that, you know, from that advanced stats community, they were saying Vigneault is not doing this the way that, you know, somebody who pays close enough attention to the numbers would do it. So, you know, for instance, everybody loved his zone deployment strategy, you know, the way that he zone matched rather than line matched, send his best defensive players out to do their defensive zone draws, you know, the Sedin start almost every shift in the offensive zone. That stuff was great. But at the same time, I mean, you'd look at something like, you know, the Kevin Bieksa-Alex Edler pairing that he stuck to stubbornly game in and game out, despite the fact that, you know, their Corsi was brutal, scoring chances, they were always on the wrong end of that. You know, there were a lot of things there that people said, you know, why isn't Vigneault making these changes? So I think that the stats community is to see a new guy, and we're all just concerned that, you know, Tortorella is going to kind of be a dinosaur about things. You know, he talked a lot about us needing to be tougher and, you know, that you know, the Canucks need to have more bite. And these things are fun and interesting and tangibles and whatnot. But really, I think, you know, this community, the more intelligent hockey fans, the ones that are paying attention to the numbers, you know, they want to see that this new coach is going to bring some new ideas, but he's also going to stick to some of the new ideas that Alain Vigneault had, like the zone matching, like counting scoring chances, you know, and like really focusing on possession over just goals.
So you mentioned earlier you had a strong opinion about the Canucks' move to bring in Tortorella as their head coach. Do you want to fire away on that?
Yeah, well, you know, I honestly think that the John Tortorella hiring is going to be really, really entertaining. As soon as I heard that he was, you know, a candidate for the job, my thought was, I don't think people realize how ridiculous the Vancouver media is. And the moment that John Tortorella gets in here, I think we're going to start to see it because people really start to pay attention. We have a lot of guys in this group here that could be, you know, the West Coast Larry Brooks. There isn't just one guy. You know, there's a bunch. And on top of that, this is a city that panics over everything, and the media drives all of the crises. And we've got two post-media newspapers in one city. We're pushing page views. We're pushing, you know, anything that's going to get people clicking on the Canucks and the bread and butter of this market. So, you know, it's not like the Canucks are going to have a bad game and anybody's going to ease off of John Tortorella because he's grumpy. People are going to push him because it means that he's going to do something that's going to go viral. He's going to get into a fight with somebody. It's going to be big news. So I think that the hiring, you know, from a coaching perspective, you know, like I said, there are some things I think that Tortorella will do well, and it does sound like he's kind of amenable to some of the more kind of advanced metrics and using some of those tactics. But from the media perspective, you know, he's preaching that he's kind of turned over a new leaf and he's this new guy, you know, kind of renovated, refurbished coach, and it's bogus. As soon as the Canucks go on their first losing streak, he's going to lose it.
So
it'll be great.
So, question for you then: if you have a market with media that see blood in the water and they're going to be sharks trying to push this guy's buttons, get the hits, get the YouTube clicks, is this a fishbowl environment that he can succeed in? I know he's been in New York, obviously, and he's had varying levels of success there. Can he succeed in Vancouver?
Well, I think he can. The funny thing is, you know, if the Canucks are losing, this is going to go badly. But, I mean, if they're losing, it's going badly anyhow. So I do think that John Tortorella, you know, it sounds like his players are excited to play for him. You know, guys like the Sedins, people talk about them being soft, but the reality is they can handle it. I mean, these guys, they basically turn cross checks into kinetic energy. Like they're tough players. They like a coach that's going to push them and challenge them, and they like doing the dirty work. So I don't think that, you know, Tortorella is going to have any trouble getting his players to buy in. But if the team is struggling, this is the city where things are going to fall apart. Like, I honestly think the Canucks are either going to be top five in the NHL next year or bottom five. Like, I really don't think that there's a way that this team has a middle ground next year under John Tortorella. Like, either it all works or it doesn't work at all.
Looking at Vancouver's success over the past few seasons, personally, I see a lot of parallels between what Vancouver is going through and what Ottawa has gone through from like the late 90s through the 2000s, where they had that window. Ottawa obviously didn't. They made a cup finals like Vancouver, but they ultimately did not win the cup. Do you see Vancouver?
Your fans handled it better. I should say that.
I don't know. Some of them are still. Some of them can still be pretty fickle at times. There's some negative fans out here too.
Is Ottawa still pressing charges against people from something that happened 3 years ago? Because
we're
I think you guys handled it better.
Yeah, that's true too. We're still waiting for that Danny Heatley arbitration settlement thing to happen, but we're not holding our breaths for that. But it, just in terms of the windows of opportunity, do you think Vancouver's is on the brink of closing?
I do. I think that, you know, when we talk about windows, we kind of look at the team that, you know, a city has right now, and there's no eye towards the future and the way that teams continually build. So, yeah, I mean, if you look at this team as it stands now, of course, they're near the end of their window. I mean, the Sedins have a few good years left. Roberto Luongo has a few good years left. And as soon as these guys start to really trend downward, then this core is probably done. But, I mean, at the same time, the Canucks have some young pieces. They're pretty clearly trying to find, you know, their next center, the guy that can be the second liner once Ryan Kessler kind of graduates to first-line status and the Sedins start to fade down the depth chart. And I mean, they've got some pieces that could work, and I do think that, yes, they're at their window now, but at the same time, it's not like we can look 2-3 years down the road and say they're going to be terrible then, because things are going to happen between now and then. So we'll see what happens.
We mentioned we're having Rob Volman on the podcast coming up. He has projected the Senators to finish first overall, win the President's Trophy next year. What do you think about that as an outsider's perspective?
That's sweet. That's a sweet thought. No, you know what? I think the Senators are going to be fantastic next year. I do. I know that the Daniel Alfredson thing was unfortunate, and you're all hurting. I'd like to buy you a Coke. But, you know, at the same time, I do think that it's one of those situations where, yeah, you know, you lost kind of a heart and soul guy. You know, it was like Vancouver losing Trevor Linden a few years ago, but it actually makes the team better. I think that, you know, Bobby Ryan is going to come in. He's going to be amazing for you guys. I think that the team as constructed, especially with what looks to be a year where everybody's healthy kind of from the outset, the Senators are going to be a really formidable team. I don't know if I'd pick them to win at all. I don't think they're my top pick, but they're definitely one of the top four or five teams in the Eastern Conference. I mean, if you're in that group, then obviously you're in the mix to win the Stanley Cup.
Plus, you've also seen how bad things can go, like the Matt Sundin thing where he comes to Vancouver. So you know the other half of the Daniel Alfredson story before it's even written,
hey,
right?
That Sundin thing was actually okay, all right? Let's not say things we can't take.
Harrison, thank you very much for coming on. Hopefully we'll have a chance to touch base with you again before the Heritage Classic, and keep up the good work for Puck Daddy, and keep posting those videos like Poon Man.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
All right, everybody, welcome back. We're just going to be jumping straight from Harrison into Rob Volman, so stay tuned. We'll be back with Rob Volman in 2 seconds.
All right, listeners, welcome back. Joining me on the line is the man from HockeyAbstract.com. He also writes for ESPN Insider and Hockey Prospectus, Rob Volman. What's going on, man?
Oh, it's great to be here, guys. Great to talk to you guys again. Haven't talked to you guys since before the last season in January. And do you guys remember what I said back then?
Yes, you were propping up the Ottawa Senators.
Yeah, everyone around there seemed to think the Senators were a bubble team. I said that they were a real contender, and they should be making the types of moves like that Silverberg for Ryan move. That would have been a good move to make a year ago.
Yeah.
Trade the prospects for some stars. And it's true. I mean, obviously, I didn't know that Spetz and Carlson and Anderson and everybody was going to get hurt. But if those guys had been in the lineup, the Senators could have fought for the Eastern Conference Championship last year, and you saw what they did to the Penguins. That was close.
So here's a question for you. At the time, you said Ottawa needs to be aggressive. They need to go out and make that splashy move. The question of the day is, did they make that move a year too late?
You know, they may have. One of the big arguments I said is that you've got to make that push while you still have Alfredson and Gonchar. I mean, hey, Ottawa's still well-positioned, but You remember what happened, of course you remember what happened earlier when there was, I don't know, a few seasons where the Ottawa was arguably the best team in the NHL, but they didn't win the cup. Because maybe they got some bad bounces, but they didn't quite crest high enough. And I think you have to pull the trigger and take some chances and take some risks. And last year, I thought, was the best year to do it, especially a 48-game season. It's not too late. I think last year was the best time, but I still think Ottawa was well-positioned.
There are some things to like. There's some things that I'm a little bit worried about. More specifically, you mentioned Daniel Offerson leaving. Creates a big hole on the second line at the right wing spot. Also, he was a bit of an insulation blanket for Kyle Turris, who enjoyed a good year playing against the opposition's first line defensive pairings. But now that Jason Spezza is back, you're getting another level of insulation there as well. But just in terms of the broad book, actually, just to bring it back to the start, I just wanted to ask you a couple questions. How wild has your whirlwind tour been since you've released the book? And secondly, how did this process come to be? What made you decide to write the book? And how long have you been thinking about putting this together?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I guess I kind of hijacked things there early
on.
No,
God, no.
couldn't wait to brag. Good question. So, yeah, the Hockey Abstract, was it launched only a week ago? I think it was launched last Friday on Edmonton AM 1260. It's been big. I mean, I've been really encouraged by everybody that's tweeted about it, that's written about it on their website, spread the word. Been on a few podcasts and shows like this one. I really think that's fantastic. I mean, even if you're not a fan for some incomprehensible reason, not a fan of me and my book, at least you can see the support that everyone has for this type of book. And I think there's a lot of people that have something to contribute towards this field of hockey analytics. And this type of, it's clear, there's a lot of, there's a real market for this. And I think that's going to get a few other people to get their work out as well.
I started reading Hockey Abstract yesterday. I found that it kind of catered. I don't know if you meant this to happen. I assume you did just by your introduction, but it kind of caters to the casual fan, which I'd call myself when it comes to fancy stats. I'm just starting to learn about them. I do feel like they're part of the puzzle, and you do mention that as well. So was that your intention, is just to educate as many people as possible as part of your intention, I guess?
Yeah, not so much educate as entertain, but yes, it's definitely targeted towards the mainstream fan. There's no question that the purpose of this book is to basically lift the veil and show people how to use analytics. It's not just a textbook that says, hey, here's a bunch of stats, here's a bunch of formulas. There are, of course, several chapters that explain how these analytics work in detail, fun detail, not long and drawn out. And its limitations, their applications, how to use them correctly. And I guess a lot of the book is actually just using those analytics in ways that the mainstream fan would enjoy. Like, there's a chapter on who's the best coach. There's a chapter on what's the luckiest team. There's a chapter on, who's the best playmaker. And of course, the focal point of a lot of the press recently has been who's the best team next year. But, it's not the answer that's so much interesting as the method. And it's the method that I sort of lay out, where you can use analytics. It's a way of thinking to complement sort of the other ways, like the experts and everything like that. You can just add this. And I think a lot of people are going to bump Ottawa up a few notches as a result, or at least I hope so.
Yeah, speaking of that, so you did have Ottawa to win the President's Trophy next year. You mentioned that luck accounts for 38% of the standings. So how do you determine that number?
Well, actually, a lot of the statistics that I use, like, luck is 38% or what have you, I don't necessarily go into a lot of detail into that stuff in the book when I'm doing something like that. I often just reference the in-depth analysis that exists elsewhere. So that's actually someone else's study. I believe that particular one is Gabriel Desjardins.
Okay.
But I basically summarize how he reached that conclusion and what that conclusion means. But for people that really want the exact detail, there's references. There's over 150 references to all sorts of different articles and magazines and and books and so on, and the specific studies that go into a lot more detail into things like that.
So when we're talking about Ottawa, and this seems to be the biggest source, as you mentioned, a lot of people are interested in projections for who is going to be the best team in the NHL next season. And your conclusion was Ottawa at a projected, I believe, it was 105 points. And I just wanted to know, how do you filter out the numbers to come to that conclusion that Ottawa is going to be the best by stripping the luck out of it?
Well, that was the basic method that I used, is I took the standings from last year and, of course, stretched out to 82 games. And then I tried to strip out all the luck-based – I tried to quantify and strip out all the luck-based components. So, for example, injuries. I looked at the extent of the injuries each team had and sort of pushed it towards the average because, you know, injuries are things that are largely outside of players' and teams' control. I mean, maybe a guy like Jason Spezza does get hurt a lot, but in general, that's something that's outside of teams' control. Who gets hurt, how long they're hurt for, that sort of thing. And there's other elements, too, like the overtime and the shootout. We've actually seen there's no correlation year to year in overtime and shootout record. There's no correlation between overtime shootout record and regulation record. It just seems to be a coin toss. I referenced a few studies that explain that. And so I like to regress the overtime and shootout record down to an average. And there's other things, too, that aren't absolute luck but do have a little bit of luck to it, especially in the short season. Things like shooting percentage, save percentage, maybe your luck on the special teams, maybe your record in one-goal games. There's luck involved in those to various extents. So basically, I tried to measure that, quantify it, remove it, and then present what I called the 2012-13 luck-neutral standings. And then I basically took a look at all the major adjustments that took place between then and I think it was around July 17th was my cutoff. So I got the first couple weeks of the free agent season. So most of the major moves. I got Bobby Ryan, for instance. I accounted for that. And then I just make the adjustments to the team based on the major roster moves. And that's how I arrived at that final standings. Now, to clear one thing up, I don't mean, hey, here are the standings, you know, tape this up and put it on your fridge. I'm just saying, hey, here's one method with which to figure out what the standings are going to be. Take this, and then also take a look at what the hockey news is saying. Take a look at what we say. Our hockey prospectus book is going to be coming out in a month or two. So take a look at what everyone else is saying and get a complete picture. But this is definitely one thing to include when you're looking at what the standings are going to be next year.
Have you tested this regressing luck factor retroactively, looking back at past seasons? And just from a predictability standpoint, is there a lot of do the results, if you have done that, have the results accurately portrayed what you're trying to prove?
That's a good question. Some things in the book are sort of well-established, things that we've been doing for years, either with ESPN or Hockey Prospectus or somewhere else. There's other things in the book that we're doing for the first time, and we're using analytics to do for the first time. And that includes this study, our look at luck and trying to quantify luck. We brushed on it in last year's Hockey Prospectus. We looked at teams like the Anaheim Ducks a couple years ago, the Nashville Predators last year, and we take a look at the luck-based factors on those teams and try to quantify it, and then predicted in their two cases that there'd be a big tumble, and of course, both those tumbles took place. So I guess you could say on an anecdotal case-by-case team-specific level, there is some basis to this, but this is the first time, I guess you could say, we've really applied it at the league-wide level. So, you know, I'm really going to be set up at the end of the year either to look like a real goof or like a genius. So if teams like Ottawa do really well, you know, I'm going to look like a genius, but if they don't, I'm going to look like a real moron. So, you know, I'm going to be cheering for Ottawa this year.
Well, I guess you're just glad that Bobby Ryan's part of that picture now, and then Ottawa's kind of stocked up in certain ways as well. I also noticed one of my favorite chapters, actually, from your book was the chapter that looked at the most lopsided trades in NHL history. Maybe you can take us through what inspired you to go off on a different tangent like that, and then we can get into a little further Ottawa-centric details from there.
You know, the lopsided trade piece was actually originally inspired by a piece I did for ESPN. I guess it was 2 or 3 years ago. And it was actually one of the record-breaking pieces. It got like the most hits of an ESPN insider hockey piece at the time. It was basically just the five most lopsided trades in history and what we can learn from them. It was a trade deadline piece, and it was really, really popular. And since then, I've come to understand that that's a really popular topic. And I wanted to show analytics in as many ways as possible. And so I talked about who's the best coach and who's the best playmaker and who's the best team and who's the best goalie. And I guess which was the best trade seemed like another logical thing to include in my set of sort of 10 questions. And the process there was similar to the ESPN article. I made some decisions about how to evaluate the trade. And, of course, I review what those decisions are because someone else might decide to approach it slightly differently. And then I used a catch-all statistic called GVT to evaluate how good players were throughout their careers after the trade. And then just take a look at the two piles of players that get exchanged. I looked at hundreds of different trades, and I looked at which ones had the biggest difference between the two piles. And so the Lindros trade is what everyone seems to think is one of the worst trades in history, and it was pretty darn close. But I actually found a couple that were more one-sided than that, although one perhaps on a technicality. And although there was a trade for Eric Lindros that was proposed by the New York Rangers that had that one gone through instead of the Flyer trade, then it would have been the most one-sided trade in history.
Who was involved in that again? Refresh my memory.
The actual trade with the Flyers involved Peter Forsberg, Mike Ricci, Ron Hextall.
Steve Duchesne, who came to
draft
Iowa.
Draft picks.
Yeah.
Kerry Huffman, or was it Steve Duchesne? Like, it was a nice big collection. The New York Rangers deal offered, like, Doug Waite, Alexei Kovalev, I think it was John Van Beesbrook, James Patrick, a couple of first rounders, a pile of money. It was quite a collection.
Judging from your piece, if the popularity of the article speaks for itself, it just goes to show you how many fans always kind of hold on to that moment. I like people still in Ottawa still talk about Alex Degg, Paul Kariya, Chris Pronger. Like, it just happened about, what, 2 years ago? But I mean, that's almost going 20 years back now. But one trade that Ottawa had at the top of your list was the Alexei Yashin for Jason Spezza, Zdeno Chara, and the infamous Bill McCult. Why don't you just take us through some of that process and how often Mike Milbury appeared on your list?
Yeah, that was a pretty nasty trade. That chapter has a table of the 60 most lopsided trades. A table of the 60 most lopsided trades I could find. But I also did short little write-ups on the 20 most lopsided trades. And so I do have a short write-up on the Yashin trade, as well as a few other Milbury gems. Now, we don't know what's going on inside the GM room and what factors lead to them making certain trades. But I try to explain the logic of a trade from the perspective of both teams. And some of them were tougher than others. And it was tough. I mean, Alexei Yashin was an extremely talented and skilled player. And, of course, Jason Spezza, I believe he was either only a prospect or a pick. He didn't know he was going to be as good as he was. And so I guess you could see to an extent what Mike Milbury was trying to do. But Milbury does show up several times, which is why people do build the narrative that he was a weak GM. If it was just the one trade, we could perhaps explain it. But he showed up several times, I think two or three times, high up on the list. There are a couple other GMs that had some really tough stretches as well. There was a guy in Detroit and a guy in St. Louis that also had some really bad stretches of trades as well.
I've been having these conversations with a couple of friends who are in the, they're starting to feel their way into the analytics stages, and you know, they have questions about quality of competition and quality of teammates and relative Corsi. And just one of the things that I've always kind of noticed with the analytics committee is we talk about players being sheltered, like it's a detriment to the player. Do you find that when you're talking about players being sheltered or insulated versus other teammates, that we're always kind of looking at it from the detriment of the player, or we're looking at his shortcomings instead of a coach per se, maybe being more aware of what the player's shortcomings are and utilizing them in a better role?
Yeah, that's very astute. Like the Sedins are a classic example of a line that is the Sedins and Burrows of a line that's considered sheltered or insulated. And yet no one in their right minds would accuse the Sedins of being weak defensively. They are solid two-way players. They proved that earlier in their careers, throughout their careers. However, Alain Vigneault made the choice that their offensive abilities were so dominant that he'd rather have the two focus on their offense, because he got other guys that can play defensively, whether it's Ryan Kessler, whether it's Manny Malhotra. He had other players to handle that. And so I wouldn't be surprised in New York if he did the similar thing this year with the Rangers, if he chose a couple of guys. Like, Rick Nash is a pretty decent two-way player. Brad Richards isn't necessarily a huge liability defensively, but he's probably going to use them for their offensive talents and then just use someone like Ryan Callahan as a pack mule, much like Ryan Kesler in Vancouver. But you're right. Sometimes we say sheltered as if, hey, if you're used offensively, that must mean that you're bad defensively. Or some people even say, hey, some guys are taking all the tough minutes. They're good defensively. But you also have to look at the results. There's some guys that are used in a very, very defensive role, but they get absolutely murdered. So, I mean, that doesn't mean they're good defensively. I mean, anyone can get murdered. So you're right. I'm just saying that someone's shelter, that someone's playing the tough minutes, isn't really enough to make a judgment about him.
Well, and that's kind of my point. Like, I was coming back to the Carlson-Norris Trophy season, for example, and you, on the surface, you see a player who doesn't necessarily play the shorthanded minutes that many of the other Norris candidates, like Chera, even McDonough at the time was having a great season, I believe. Or no, it was the Girardi, I think. People in New York were tooting his horn a little bit. And Shea Weber, for example. But, I mean, Erik Karlsson's, you know, 180 pounds. He's small. You don't want that guy. You know, he's your best premier defenseman who's instead having his shorthanded minutes being played at the five-on-five level where he's a bigger effect. You know, he's playing with the puck as opposed to sitting in his own net in front of the net, basically doing puck pursuit the whole time for 2 minutes. So it's just, for me, I'd like to see the coaches get a little bit more credit for how they're utilizing their personnel as opposed to looking at the limitations of the players themselves.
Absolutely, and I think we talked a little bit about this in an earlier podcast as well. Carlson, I don't know why he got the reputation as of being a defensive liability. According to his analytics, he wasn't. I mean, he was playing top-line minutes against top opponents. Sure, he wasn't being used in defensive situations, but why would you use Carlson in defensive situations? But then other people would say silly things about how, like, Kuba was carrying him, which now I think it's... I mean, it sounded ridiculous at the time, but even now that we've seen Kuba without him, we know that that's also very ridiculous. So, yeah, it's bizarre. And the same thing people are saying about P.K. Subban in Montreal. He won the Norris, and he's an offensive-minded kind of guy. He doesn't play a lot of defensive minutes either. However, I don't know. I don't think we've heard the same narrative about Subban that we did about Carlson. I think with Carlson, it was a very almost personal thing with him, because Subban, I mean, his usage is roughly the same as Carlson's was. And I don't think he's gotten the same heat as being a defensive liability as Carlson did. Am I right?
No, I have to say, like, I covered a lot of games for Hockey Night in Canada last year, working Habs games, working their regional coverage. And you noticed the same kind of narratives being played out. You know, you had Markov and you had Georges playing the tougher minutes, right, against the higher-level competition. Yeah, they're playing more minutes against the top lines, but they're not necessarily killing it, like you said, right? And then you have Subban, whose possession numbers are off the charts. He's controlling the play. He's a threat every time he's on the ice. And, you know, you still have that whole pull of just because a guy's playing 20 minutes doesn't necessarily mean he's playing them that great.
Yeah, the real appeal, I think, of Hockey Abstract, I mean, to some people, it's just going to be a reference guide where they have a reference of hard-to-find statistics and a glossary of them and a sort of a list of a bunch of studies. But I think for a lot of people, the real appeal is going to be helping understand how to use analytics properly. Because you're right, a lot of times when we're reading an article or we're listening to a podcast or something, we hear something that doesn't sound right. A lot of times because those analytics aren't being used properly. They're not being put in the right context. They're not being, you know, complemented with the right information. And that it was nice to write a book where I can really take my time and actually explain the applications and the limitations of each statistic carefully, something you can't really do in a podcast or in a quick article.
So for when you're looking at a player, where do things like heart, clutch, and leadership, things that can't really be calculated, where does that fit in with like possession numbers and everything like that for you?
That's a really good question, and I've got a few answers to it. The first thing is, I actually, in one of my chapters, it's called the Do-It-All Index, or actually try to create a statistic that could measure and find players that can do it all, you know, like the Gordie Howes of the league, guys that do everything. But in that chapter, I also hint at the fact that you could actually use the same method to try to score and find the players, you know, that had the grit or the heart or their clutch or whatever it is that you wanted to measure. I mean, it wouldn't be as perfect as counting passes and counting shots when it's obvious one or zero, but at least it would get you sort of started. But the other things I'd say about this topic is it's very difficult for me because it's very hard to measure those things. And if you do measure it, you're often measuring it after the fact. Like, I can tell you now that Marc Messier was a clutch player. But if you had asked me in 1980, hey, is this guy going to be clutch? that's a really hard thing to predict. I've never seen anyone successfully predict who is going to be clutch, who is going to play with a lot of heart, who's going to be a great leader. It's only something we know after the fact. And so while that's still interesting, I'm concerned about whether that's really a useful thing to look at, since we don't really know in advance. It's nothing we can use to predict anything. And that, certainly, in that chapter we talked about the standings, there's going to be some team that has a great leader step forward and a big pack of third and fourth liners that play with tremendous heart and they just win a lot of clutch games. You know that's going to happen. Just how can anyone predict it? You can't predict that unless you have heart and clutch. So you can't predict that. And that's why I'm also, a lot of times I use the word luck, and I know people don't like to use the word luck. Unfortunately, that's part of what I mean by luck. I think if you have a guy on your team that becomes a great leader, or you have a bunch of lines that play with a lot of heart and clutch and so on, a lot of grit, I think that is luck. It's luck that you just happen to have guys that really picked it up like that. And so I kind of, when I use the word luck, I kind of defined it in the book what I meant by luck, and I kind of meant to include things like that.
So a question for you. We're talking about luck, and you just mentioned, you know, you can't really predict how guys are going to play. Do you think there's ever going to be a moment, and this kind of pertains to how GMs build their teams, do you think there's ever going to be a moment where GMs can kind of ascertain chemistry for a line and which players can click playing with other players? Because that's team building, and that's the essence of what you're trying to do.
I think, yes, there's a way that analytics can play a role. Just like any problem, analytics plays a role. It doesn't do the job. It just plays a role. And, yes, I do believe analytics can play a role in finding chemistry. And you do it by taking a look. The analytics can tell you the style of the player. They can start to paint a picture of the situations in which a player is going to be successful. And a classic example that's really on everyone's minds these days is Mikhail Grabowski. That player is of a very particular type of talent. And we saw that when he was using one sort of situation a couple of years ago, he impressed everybody and he got this huge $5.5 million contract. But when he was used in sort of a different situation with different line mates, I mean, he was terrible. He was uninspired. None of his fans had confidence in him. His coach lost confidence in him. So, and I think analytics could have actually caught that for us. I think analytics would have warned them that perhaps putting Grabowski on the third line, on a tough minutes line with guys like Jay McClement and Nikolai Kuhlman, wasn't playing to Grabowski's strengths, and that he would have been better off. His possession-oriented style of carrying the puck around with him might have been better off with guys like Lupul or Kessel or someone that can actually do something with that skill.
It's interesting. Last question from me, and this kind of plays on the same thing in terms of the unknown. In the book, right during the introduction, you mentioned that baseball has been essentially, you know, they've had these numbers for decades. And, you know, they cracked the surface essentially in the 90s, 2000s. You have your Moneyball movement, and it's, you know, just the influence of on-base percentage in baseball. Now with hockey, we're starting to see the information and what's available to us is becoming more and more available. How far away or how long do you think it'll take before we're at a similar level? Will it take that long, decades, or is this something that's going to kind of pick up steam and gain momentum moving forward?
Well, that's hard to say. You know, a lot of the stuff, though, that we're doing with hockey is stuff that you know, we're doing with baseball about 30 years ago. And so there's definitely a lot of catch up. Now, that being said, there's also been a lot of momentum that we've gained in the last few years. There's been a growing movement of interest in hockey analytics, driven mostly by the fans, but it's also penetrated into scouts and coaches and agents and journalists. Not so much the head offices, but it'll get there. And as a result, it's hard to tell when we're going to catch up with baseball because it's also a moving target. There's also new developments in baseball, and there's also still lots of teams in baseball that haven't adopted analytics. So it's a moving target. So I don't know if ever you're going to catch baseball, but I think there's going to be a lot of momentum. And, if there wasn't a lot of momentum, I don't think this book, Hockey Abstract, on hockey analytics, I don't think it would have gotten off to such a hot start if there wasn't a huge appetite for it.
Well, it's been a well-written book from the chapters that I've read thus far. I've probably read about 100 pages, 150 pages or so. I have to echo Creech's comments from earlier as well. I thought the tone of the book itself was very well done. It's not that condescending, you know, this is the way it is and this is how we should interpret hockey. You open up
stats and present them to the reader and say, let's have a debate. Let's think about this from, you know, a different way of thinking that normally people who just enjoy the game of hockey wouldn't necessarily be exposed to.
Yeah, I appreciate those comments. If there's two things I've learned over the years from all the readers and fans, it's number one, the directions that they're most interested in. Like we talked about the lopsided trades and things like that. So the direction that they want analytics to go, like what they want analytics to answer for them. And the second thing I've learned is how to strike the right tone. I think when you're working with hockey analytics, you have to have a thick skin. But I also think you've got to be careful when you present it. You can't present it as it being a standalone, foolproof, comprehensive, one stat does the job. You're an idiot if you don't understand it. Like, that's not the right tone. You need to say, listen, here's another way of looking at it, like in addition to the scouting. And I know, as I've always said, analytics works best in two situations. Number one, as a sober second thought to traditional analysis, like if you're scouting a player or a team or a situation, analytics can sort of help just confirm your findings. It also works very well trying to find things that you've overlooked and that require your attention. You can't watch all 82 games for all 30 teams, and you can't watch all the games in the AHL and the U.S. colleges and the Canadian juniors in Europe and so on. If there's a way that analytics can pull out the information that you're most interested in for you to then go focus your attention on, then that is absolutely the primary service that analytics can provide today.
Anybody who's listening to this show, if you can, go to Amazon.com. Buy hockeyabstract.com. It's a worthwhile read. Rob, thank you again for coming on the podcast. Love having you on. We'll try and get you on at some point during the season when we'll see how the numbers are playing out. But thanks again for coming on. That was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. And maybe if Ottawa's doing extremely well at the end of the year and they win the President's Trophy, you can get me a little tweet. Plug.
I'll give you a tweet. We'll serenade you in Ottawa. We'll bring you into town, and I don't know, maybe Eugene Melnick can shake your hand or something. Rob, thanks for coming on, and take care. Yeah. All the best.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Cheers. We'd be crime fighters together and do things that brothers do. When you told me about his mother and all that she'd been through, what could I do?